Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Dispatch 9. As always, I want to start by thanking you for supporting the show. I couldn't do it without you guys. I thought we'd start today with a reading from one of Napoleon's letters to his brother Joseph, now King of Naples. Napoleon's letters to Joseph are a great resource. They're very widely available for free, and given the two men's closeness, Napoleon seems a bit less guarded and reserved than usual. Typically, Napoleon wrote with one eye towards public opinion and posterity, not necessarily revealing his true thoughts. This letter is from March 1, 1807, just after the events we'll be discussing next episode. Quote, "Neither the staff, nor the colonels, nor the other regimental officers have taken their clothes off for the last 2 months, some not for 4 months. I myself have been a fortnight without taking off my boots. In the middle of snow and mud, without bread, wine, or brandy, living on potatoes and meat, making long marches and countermarches without any sort of comfort, fighting with our bayonets, frequently under grapeshot, the wounded obliged to be removed in sledges, in the open air, to a distance of 50 leagues. To compare us with the army of Naples, making war in that beautiful country, where they have bread, wine, oil, linen sheets to their beds, society, and even women, looks like an attempt at a joke. After having destroyed the Prussian monarchy, we are fighting the remnant of the Prussians, and against the Russians, Cossacks and Kalmyks, and the tribes of the north, who formerly conquered the Roman Empire. We have war in all its fierceness and all its horrors. In such fatigue, everyone has become more or less ill, except myself, for I was never stronger. I have grown fat." End quote. So, as you can see, even Napoleon was complaining about the conditions. I think this campaign is the first time in my research that all my sources are so unanimous. It almost doesn't matter whose memoirs or diaries you read, or even which side they fought on. Once you read a few primary sources from this period, you can almost predict what everyone else is going to say. Bad roads, bad weather, bad food, brutal combat, and constant fatigue. Soldiers' memoirs and correspondence are often full of complaints. Napoleonic warfare was an uncomfortable and frightening business. And, as we've seen in many past episodes, militaries and governments often struggled to keep their men properly supplied, paid, and equipped. However, I don't think I've ever seen griping on this scale before. Going into this series of episodes, I knew that the Grande Armée and their opponents suffered terribly in this campaign, but it's another thing entirely to actually see that demonstrated again and again with real first-person accounts. These past few episodes have given me a whole new appreciation for the toughness of these soldiers. Anyway, on to your questions. Peter Torvik asked, "I work in fine dining, and popular history tends to emphasize the French Revolution as the point where chefs, cooks, and household workers formerly employed by aristocratic and noble houses began to work for newly established businesses, selling their services to a newly established bourgeois clientele. How true is this, and what other industries made a similar leap from aristocratic privilege to luxury services?" First of all, great question, but before I dive in, we should define our terms. Obviously, places where a person could buy prepared food have existed since ancient times. Any reasonably complex society needs places where people who are away from home at mealtime can eat. When we say restaurant in this context, we mean it very narrowly, specifically the Western fine dining establishment. A place with an attractive interior dining room, waiters, menus, professional chefs, etc. This type of eating establishment is relatively new. They developed in Western Europe, mostly France, in the 19th century. The first institutions that historians consider modern restaurants actually began to appear in Paris just before the Revolution, in the last third or so of the 18th century. They specialized in serving various broths and stocks, which was a bit of a health food craze at the time. It was believed a good broth could restore vigor and vitality, hence the word restaurant, which originally meant something like restorative. I have to admit, I find it amusing that so-called bone broth has become trendy again. We really have come full circle, back to one of the very first health foods. By 1798, this was still a new phenomenon. There were only a handful of these establishments in Paris, and none anywhere else in the world. The Revolution turned this small, local trend into something more. As you mentioned in your question, the emigration of the nobility left hundreds of France's best cooks and domestic servants looking for new employment. Many of them simply went to work for the new ruling class, much in the same way they had worked for the old ruling class. You might remember that we talked about this in Dispatch 3, when I read a bit from the memoirs of Captain Elzéar Blas, in which he talked about eating on campaign, and the fact that many of the generals of Napoleon's army employed former personal chefs of aristocrats, who had been drafted into the army. But not everyone could simply find a new patron. That old model of employing a personal chef and waitstaff was not as viable in post-revolutionary France. That old model was tied to the social structure of the old regime, with a very small ruling class lording over everyone else. The restaurant fit much better with the new atmosphere after the revolution, with the bourgeoisie increasingly powerful, and their more democratic and market-oriented ethos coming to the forefront. Unlike in a private kitchen, a restaurant was open to all. Anyone who could afford to pay, that is. Your access to the best food and service was dictated by how successful you were in business, not by who you knew or what your title was. It's a bit strange to think of a fine dining restaurant as a democratic, modern establishment, but compared to the private kitchens of the aristocracy, that's what they were. We can see similar phenomena in other luxury trades. I've read similar stories about the gunsmiths who made high-quality firearms for hunting or presentation, and the makers of gloves and shoes and other high-end accessories. With the Revolution, these people generally went from being essentially well-paid servants at the court of Versailles, who catered exclusively to the aristocracy, to independent businessmen, who worked for anyone with cash on hand. That might seem like a distinction without difference, but it mattered a great deal to these people. In fact, I think this goes a long way to explaining why so many artisans, small businessmen, and skilled workers supported the revolution. This new type of society was much better for them, both economically and psychologically. At least in theory, they could now rise in society and become wealthy based on their skills alone. And their new clients among the wealthy bourgeoisie liked it too. They now had access to all the luxuries that had once been reserved for the aristocracy, but without the expense of employing a full-time staff, and without having to replicate the master-servant dynamic, which many of them found old-fashioned and philosophically unpalatable. So, to answer your question, technically the modern restaurant was already coming into being by 1789, but the Revolution massively accelerated this process, and is probably the key turning point in the history of the modern service economy. However, it is worth mentioning that this type of social change is a very slow process. By the end of the Napoleonic Wars, restaurants were still in their infancy. Their development and popularity didn't really take off until after the end of our story. For instance, the man who is often considered the first modern celebrity chef, Auguste Escoffier, wasn't even born until 1846. Interestingly, Escoffier served in the French army under a different Bonaparte, Napoleon III. He was the head chef of the Army of the Rhine during the Franco-Prussian War. If you're interested in this, there's a history podcast called The Siècle that covers the period between Napoleon's downfall and the outbreak of the First World War, and they have an episode on this. Next, Nathaniel Webb asked, In your episodes on Jena and Auerstedt, you mentioned the failure of Napoleon's intelligence apparatus, and the importance of intelligence has come up repeatedly during the Polish campaign. How was interrogation conducted during this era? Or, to put it more bluntly, would captured enemy soldiers be tortured for information? This is kind of a difficult question to answer, because there was huge variation in how prisoners were treated. Depending on luck, where and when a soldier was captured, and by whom, their experience could be almost totally painless. Some men were simply forced to sign a piece of paper, pledging not to take any further part in the war, and then allowed to return home. On the other end of the spectrum, there were cases in which men were tortured to death, or killed in spectacular, horrifying ways. Not even to make them talk, just to satisfy the anger or sadism of their captors. So, surrendering in this period was a roll of the dice. The context in which a soldier was captured mattered quite a bit. Irregular forces like the Spanish guerrillas or the Italian Sanfedisti were much more likely to be violent or cruel to their prisoners, but that was not universally true. The Russians had a reputation for mistreatment of prisoners, but that was mostly because of the behavior of the Cossacks. Thousands of French soldiers who were captured by regular Russian troops lived relatively well in captivity. Perhaps unsurprisingly, officers tended to fare much, much better than their men. The large-scale prisoner of war camps that would become features of 20th century warfare did not exist yet. And so, captured officers were typically sent to some rural village, far from the fighting, and allowed to live more or less freely. Typically, their captors provided them with a stipend, and required them to check in regularly with a kind of parole officer stationed in the area. But other than that, they lived normal lives, and even socialized with their neighbors. Judging from primary sources, prisoners sometimes volunteered information to their captors. However, you would have to imagine that someone writing a memoir of their military service might gloss over their comrades beating or abusing the prisoners to encourage them to, quote-unquote, volunteer useful information. However, it's important to remember that soldiers of this era were often not quite as committed to the cause as we might imagine. Prisoners picked up between battles were often deserters from the enemy army. They had already given up on their allegiance to their old unit and comrades. If they didn't feel a strong connection to the cause, why not trade away whatever useful knowledge they might have in exchange for better treatment? It seems that some deserters even sought out the enemy. Showing up at the enemy camp with a useful bit of information was a relatively safe way out of the war. That might seem strange, but these types of defectors were a relatively common part of warfare for centuries. Even in the Second World War, there were cases of soldiers crossing the lines to trade away a little information for a ticket away from the front. A lot of incidents of torture and cruelty of prisoners that you do read about from this period seem to have nothing to do with the collection of intelligence. When torture took place, it was often for purposes of intimidation, to sow terror among the enemy. We saw this in our episodes on Haiti and in our discussions of partisan warfare in southern Italy during the chaos of the French conquest, and we will see it in Spain and Russia before our story is over. Next, Max asked a related question. Actually, he asked a whole bunch of questions, but I picked one of them. How did the French and coalition intelligence agencies differ in terms of their complexity and efficacy? Well, for starters, it's important to keep in mind that by today's standards, intelligence during this period was essentially amateur. We can't even really talk about intelligence agencies as cohesive professional institutions. Almost everything in this world of espionage was irregular. There wasn't much bureaucracy or official procedure backing things up. Governments and militaries certainly recognized the importance of intelligence. Huge sums of money were spent on intelligence gathering, and important decisions were sometimes made on the basis of information gleaned through all that spending. However, this was very much viewed as a dark art, something ungentlemanly and even slightly seedy, to be carried out quietly and outside official channels. Even as recently as the late 19th century, many states did not have fully professionalized espionage institutions. Many even refused to publicly acknowledge that they employed spies and informants on any kind of permanent large-scale basis. So all of that is to say that in the Napoleonic era, military intelligence was still very much in the Dark Ages. Anyway, to get to the heart of your question, French intelligence was very well regarded. We've already discussed the exploits of Karl Schulmeister, who penetrated the Austrian headquarters in 1805, and actually sat in on their deliberations in the run-up to the Battle of Austerlitz, giving Napoleon a huge advantage. We've also already discussed Joseph Fouché, the sinister ex-Jacobin who served as Minister of Police under successive French governments, and was legendary for his skills at intrigue. There was also Foreign Minister Talleyrand, who was technically a diplomat, not a spy master, but was such a natural conspirator that he sometimes blurred the lines between the two professions. There was also General Savary, who I really need to get around to introducing in the main narrative. He was part of Napoleon's inner circle and had a special talent for espionage and conspiracy. Ultimately, Savary would come to replace Fouché, who was undoubtedly talented, but unreliable and not very loyal to Napoleon or anyone else. Just like in many spheres of French life, the Revolution had allowed talented men to rise to the top of the intelligence world, men who probably would not have been given the chance to prove themselves under the old regime. I think Napoleon himself also had a hand in France's intelligence successes. He cultivated an image as a man who always generously rewarded people who did him a good service. This type of reputation is an invaluable tool for any ruler, in all kinds of situations, including intelligence gathering. People with useful information made sure to find their way to Napoleon, confident that he would pay them whatever it was worth. The French also sometimes relied on ideological converts, people who still believed in the promise of the Revolution and wanted to help Napoleon topple the old order in their own countries. British intelligence was also quite formidable during the Napoleonic Wars. Britain had a lot of money, and like Napoleon, the British government cultivated a reputation for generosity to anyone who helped advance British interests. They also had access to thousands of French émigrés, people who spoke French fluently, had connections within the country, and were willing to do almost anything to undermine Bonaparte. Like the French, the British also relied on ideological fellow travelers, conservatives or reactionaries who hated what Napoleon stood for, and people who simply saw the French as dangerous foreign invaders and wanted them expelled from their conquests. And, like the French, the British had competent, well-regarded people handling their intelligence, men like William Wickham and Colquhoun Grant, both of whom are interesting characters and well worth reading about, although maybe not quite as colorful as Fouché or Talleyrand. Next, George Arnault asked, "We've heard multiple times about the rivalries within the Marshalate, Murat and Ney, Davout and Bernadotte, etc. Did any of these rivalries extend down to the rank and file, or did soldiers overall see themselves as members of the Grande Armée, more so than members of any individual corps?" As I'm sure a lot of you are probably aware, ranking Napoleon's marshals and discussing their strengths and weaknesses is a hugely popular pastime today among scholars and students of Napoleonic history. As I began researching this show, I was amused to find it was just as popular back then among French soldiers. The men of the Grande Armée loved to gossip about the army's internal politics, from the officers and men of their own regiments all the way up to the marshals and Napoleon's headquarters. It seems Everyone had his own theories and speculation about who was in favor, who was out of favor, who deserved his position, and who owed his blue baton to friendship or connections. It almost reminds me of the way people talk about sports, whose marshal is overrated versus whose quarterback is overrated. With all that said, I don't think these rivalries and bickering between the men ever reached the same level that it did among the marshals. As we've already seen in past episodes, bad feelings between the marshals could have real consequences on the battlefield. But I don't know of any cases in which rivalries between different corps filtered down to the field officers or troops in any way that actually changed the course of events. I'm sure there were lots of barroom brawls and pranks, but I don't know of anything that actually had an impact on the course of the war. Next, Jacob Hufstadter asked, "I'm curious about your writing style. Do you write your script with footnotes, endnotes, and the like, or is it more informal? How is writing a script different from writing in a more academic setting?" I typically start with a document that is sort of a cross between notes and an outline. I fill it up with citations and quotations from whatever books or articles I'm using for that episode, and move them around in the document until I find a structure or rhythm that I like. Then I go over the document and try to explain it to myself out loud in my own words, think it over, and try out different phrasing. So by the time I'm ready to sit down and write the script, I usually already have a pretty good idea of what I'm going to say. The scripts themselves are very sparse, no endnotes or footnotes or anything like that. Two little tips for any aspiring podcasters out there. I write out all numbers, for instance, spelling T-W-O rather than using the numeral 2, because, for whatever reason, I sometimes stumble over numerals. Second, I put any difficult-to-pronounce foreign words in bold, so they don't catch me by surprise. I also format things a bit differently. The paragraph breaks don't come at the end of a paragraph, they come where there's a natural break in speech. So the paragraphs tend to be shorter. I don't find writing a script to be very similar to academic writing. The more academic side of it is all in that earlier notes and outline phase. By the time I get around to writing the script, I'm focused on telling the story. I find it much more similar to journalistic writing, but maybe that's just because I've done a lot of journalistic writing in the past. Apparently, some people think this is all off the cuff, but basically everything in the show is scripted. Sometimes I change the wording on the fly, and every once in a while I ad-lib a sentence or two, but generally speaking, everything you guys hear is pre-written. Just as an aside, when I started doing the dispatches, I thought there would be a lot of questions like this, about the process of creating the show. I'm surprised this was the first one after 8 months. Anyway, that's all for now. I thought we'd close out with something a little bit different. In honor of St. Patrick's Day, here is a traditional Irish song from the early 19th century about the Napoleonic Wars, Arthur MacBride, performed by the band Planxty. As always, thanks for listening.
I had a first cousin called Arthur MacBride. He and I took a stroll down by the seaside, a seeking good fortune and what might betide. 'Twas just as the day was a-dawning. Then after resting we both took a tramp. We met Sergeant Harper and Corporal Cramp, besides the wee drummer who beat up for camp with this rowdy-dow-dow in the morning. He says, "My young fellows, if you will enlist, a guinea quickly shall have in your fist, besides a crown for to kick off of the dust, and drink the king's health in the morning. Had we been such fools as to take the advance, the wee bit of more and we had to run chance. For you think it no scruple to send us to France, where we would be killed in the morning." He says, my young fellows, if I hear but one word, I instantly now will out with my sword, and into your bodies as strength will afford. So now, my gay devils, take warning. But Arthur and I, we took in the odds. We gave them no chance for to launch out their swords. Our whacking shillelaghs came over their heads and paid them right smart in the morning. As for the wee drummer, we rifled his pouch and we made a football of his rowdy dow-dow, and into the ocean to rock and to roll, and bad at the tedious returning. As for the old rapier that hung by his side, we flung it as far as we could in the tide. To the devil I pitch you, says Arthur McBride, to temper your steel in the morning.